Welcome back everyone to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. Big day in the news, big day over the G7 and in Brazil. It's not good news though, so just buckle up for that. But through the course of this episode, we are gonna talk about quite a bit. We've got updates on climate change, what Donald Trump is going to do or more likely not do about climate change. We've got two different congressional candidates gonna be joining us. Two awesome candidacies, Arizona and California, including a primary challenger to a little known candidate. You might have seen references in a newspaper at one point, Nancy Pelosi. Oh damn. Primary challenge to the leader of the Dems in the House. And then we're gonna close out the show. Oh, Emma Vigeland is gonna be joining us as well. She was at a protest yesterday outside of the VMAs having to do with clean water. So she's gonna be joining us to talk about what happened there. And then we're gonna be closing out the show contrasting Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders on the media, on the free press. What do they think of the press today? And what are their solutions to get it to where it needs to be in the future? So we're gonna lay out both of their approaches and see if we can figure out a winner out of those two. So should be a lot of fun, but we are gonna be starting off with Donald Trump and the G7. Donald Trump did not make it to the climate summit at the G7, but in his defense, he had a good excuse. It was distributed by Stephanie Grisham, his press secretary, who said the president had scheduled meetings and bilaterals with Germany and India. So a senior member of the administration attended in his stead, which look, climate change is important to me. And so obviously I would prefer if our president took an interest in it, but if he's gonna be meeting with the heads of Germany and India, two incredibly important countries, then obviously that has to take precedence. But it didn't happen, it's a big lie because a photo was leaked from the actual climate summit. Let's take a look and you might notice a couple of figures there. Oh, that's Angela Merkel and Narendra Modi, the leaders of Germany and India that he was supposedly meeting with. I think he nicknamed a Big Mac Angela and a Filet-O-Fish Narendra. And then he had a meeting at a Burger King. I think that's what actually happened. So he was simply lying. He didn't care enough about climate change to go. And so he made up some BS story that honestly, let's keep it real. They had no hope that it wouldn't get out that India and Germany had been at the climate summit. They knew that it would be released. So they told this story knowing it would be disproven so that they could spit in your face if you care about climate change, if you feel like it's important and we should prioritize it. This is his way of giving you the middle finger and making it clear that he doesn't give a damn about any of these related issues. Now, I know that that's probably not gonna come as much of a surprise. He is a climate denier, he believes it's a Chinese hoax and all of that. Which would be one thing, but he wants to have his climate change cake and eat it too. He wants to say that it's not happening, but imply that in fact, he's the true environmentalist. You, a person, perhaps a good progressive who prioritizes dealing with our climate crisis. No, you're fake environmentalist. He's the real one, and he has been for a very long time. It's sort of in his blood. He said once, I mean, you have scientists on both sides of it. My uncle was a great professor at MIT for many years, Dr. John Trump. And I didn't talk to him about this particular subject, but I have a natural instinct for science. So his uncle did something in science. We have no idea if it was climate related. He didn't even talk to him about it, but it's in his blood. He understands science better than us plebs possibly ever could. And so the thing is, at one of the press conferences at the G7, he wasn't at the actual climate summit, but he was asked questions about these issues. He couldn't avoid that. And so he spoke on the issue, but not in a way that I found particularly reassuring. So first, here he is talking about the need for us to extract even more fossil fuels out of the ground.
I feel that the United States has tremendous wealth. The wealth is under its feet. I've made that wealth come alive. We will soon be exporting. In fact, we're actually doing it now, exporting. But we are now the number one energy producer in the world, and soon it will be by far, with a couple of pipelines that have not been able to get approved for many, many years. It'll have a huge impact. It's tremendous wealth, and LNG is being sought after all over Europe and all over the world, and we have more of it than anybody else. And I'm not gonna lose that wealth. I'm not gonna lose it on dreams, on windmills, which frankly aren't working too well. I'm not gonna lose it.
I think he lost it actually, that's my takeaway from that. So on dreams, the idea that we should stop our civilization from being perhaps irreparably damaged, maybe destroyed, is a dream. The idea that we could, what part of it is a dream? That we couldn't make our like homes and vehicles more energy efficient, that we couldn't switch over to more renewable forms of energy? We can't do that. That's a dream. It's not a challenge. It's not difficult. You know, it's not an obstacle that we have to surpass, that we could perhaps come together as a people, as a country, across party lines and accomplish it, as we've accomplished, you know, huge significant obstacles in the past. Defeating the Nazis, that was difficult. Might have seemed like a dream initially before we stormed those beaches, but we did figure it out. Even environmental challenges like dealing with acid rain, the hole in the ozone layer, incredibly difficult. Huge issues, but we did it. We did it relatively quickly. It didn't become a big crisis, perhaps because the corporate interests didn't have enough time to buy politicians to get on their side there, but we did it. No, this is a dream. No, the dream for him is endless corporate profits until, you know, the oceans finally swamp their factory. Just getting as much money as possible, that is the dream, and that is the dream that he's working towards. I have a slightly different dream. I have a dream here in America that we put an expiration date on literally every coal using plant, every oil field, every oil refinery, every LNG facility, every fracking operation should have an expiration date in the relatively near future. And we should ramp up using whatever funds are necessary to replace them as quickly as possible with renewable energy, which despite Donald Trump, the expert on wind energy, is actually doing quite well. Wind energy and especially solar energy are better and better every single year, cheaper and cheaper every single year. We should put all the resources necessary to replace our dirty fuel in as few years as possible. And when we finally close down the last coal plant, the last oil plant, you know what we do? We have a massive countrywide party. That's a dream that I think we can get behind. It would be better not only for dealing with climate change, but would also in the interim produce cleaner air, cleaner water, all of that for us here in America. We would have a better future, healthier kids and grandkids. That is a dream to work towards, not let's mine every drop of oil, every lump of coal, and let's burn it, baby. Burn it up if that makes corporate profits go up marginally in the next quarter. That's a pretty sad dream. That's a pathetic dream. It's actually my nightmare. But that's the one that he's working on right now. He actually had more to say on the issue because, as I said, while all of that, he wants to focus on getting oil and coal out of the ground, he still wants to call himself an environmentalist, which he'll do here.
I'm an environmentalist. A lot of people don't understand that. I have done more environmental impact statements probably than anybody that's, I guess I can say definitely, because I've done many, many, many of them. And I think I know more about the environment than most people. I want clean air, I want clean water, I want a wealthy country, I want a spectacular country with jobs, with pensions, with so many things, and that's what we're getting.
And so look, that's the most standard Mad Libs Donald Trump statement ever. Take a subject, I know more about it than anyone, even though I know virtually nothing and I have no interest in finding out. And I understand for some people, you've heard so many statements like that, even on this program, that you get sick of it. You just can't take it anymore. And so some people will occasionally tweet me things like, why are you focusing on this? Because this isn't just bluster. It's bluster. It's not just bluster. This is like, if a society could commit suicide, this is how we do it. And he has the power to put the gun to our nation's head. He's saying as long as he's in office, there will be nothing. Not bold ideas, not even incremental ideas like under Obama. There will be no action whatsoever. You could not have a more consequential stance from our government on an issue. And it's there, and it's gonna be there as long as he's there. For the rest of his first term, second term if he gets one. It's a nightmare, but it could very well come true. And as long as he's there, we will do absolutely nothing. If there are changes to our regulations or our legislation, it'll be in the direction of more exploitation of these resources, more rights for these corporations to do whatever they want. More mining, more drilling. That is his dream in the end. Now, I want to turn to a slightly related topic, and that's going to be the Amazon. The state of the Amazon is still incredibly rough. And if you want an idea that perhaps with the G7 happening, all these countries coming together, they might do something about it. Even the US, perhaps. It has made international news, the fact that there's been like 74,000 fires there, right? Perhaps not. I woke up to this tweet from Donald Trump. I have gotten to know President Jair Bolsonaro well in our dealings with Brazil. He's working very hard on the Amazon fires and in all respects doing a great job for the people of Brazil. Not easy, He and his country have the full and complete support of the USA. Unfortunately, the full and complete support of the USA, as of right now, comes in the form of that tweet that you just saw there. That's it, that's what we're doing. And Jair Bolsonaro does not care if literally every square foot of the Amazon burned down. That is not only a possibility, that's his goal. That's what he's been working towards. We were very clear about that back before he was even elected. Donald Trump embracing Bolsonaro is not a surprise. Providing cover for him on this particular issue, considering how clear it is, that was at least a little bit surprising. But we know what Bolsonaro actually is going to do and what he has done on this issue. He blamed NGOs, which was a strategy that leaked documents show he's going to continue to use when it comes to the Amazon. He tweeted out fake photos of military jets going to help out with the burning Amazon. It was from previous years, it was from years ago, it wasn't actually happening. And we're gonna have a little tidbit of the next little sand in the eye that he's got on this issue in just a little bit. But first, I wanna step back and talk about the coverage of this topic. Massive fire, international news, but how much of it compared to another big case of something burning down? This is a Media Matters study. Look at the number of MSM segments on the Notre Dame fire earlier this year versus the fire in the Amazon. 365 segments for Notre Dame, 25 for the Amazon. Now look, Notre Dame burning down, that's bad. That is really bad. It's historic, it's a tragedy, it's terrible. It's also a travesty because it didn't need to happen. Is it 15 times more important than perhaps the most important area of wilderness on the face of our earth burning down and the world just watching it happen? Is it that many times more important? I think we can agree it's at most 4 times more important, honestly. And yet that's what happened. And the thing is, 25 segments, they're counting CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. These are 24-hour a day news outlets, 25. I mean, what did we do here on this rinky-dink online show, like 4? They could have significantly jacked up the numbers if they just included the damage report. Hell, include today's show and you could get an appreciable movement there. But no, people largely didn't care, they didn't cover it. And is it really any of a surprise? They don't understand Brazilian politics, they're not interested in actually finding out. They have no interest in bringing on experts on Brazilian politics. They generally don't care about any story that's related to climate change. They perhaps rightfully think that people aren't going to pay attention to it. Let's have a little test here, by the way. I talk about climate change all the time, knowing, by the way, that those videos are going to get fewer views. I hope that this one breaks that streak, that pattern, but I fear that it will not. It's not a sexy topic. It's literally the most important topic in the world, but it's not a sexy topic. And unfortunately, that's reflected in how CNN, MSNBC, and all the rest deal with it. So ignoring the media, let's move to the international response. There was a lot of media coverage for the G7 countries announcing that they were gonna pledge $20 million to fight the Amazon fires. That was as Trump was skipping that climate change meeting, but the G7 countries, $20 million. Now, that is not the only donations that any of these countries are going to do, but that's what they pledged together. Now, to give you an idea, those $20 million, I saw someone tweeted out the budget of Venom was $100 million. I checked out, you know what cost $20 million? Superbad cost $20 million to make. So Superbad protecting the Amazon from destruction, pretty close, pretty similar actually. Do you know that that fire in Notre Dame, how much that raised in 2 days? $1 billion, but $20 million, $20 million. And let's say that they get the $20 million. What can you do with $20 million to stop a fire this significant, this huge? Well, I tried to find out, you know, you always see that footage when there's fires, especially in California, you know, Northwest, all that, of the big planes dropping water. So I could not get an actual price specifically on a 747 outfitted for fighting fire, but a passenger one, which seems less specialized, costs $367 million. Costs hundreds of thousands of dollars per day to operate one of those planes. So $20 million, as Francesca Fiorentini, a friend of the show, said, don't spend it all on one tree. Just to give you an idea, Leonardo DiCaprio donated a quarter as much as the G7 countries did together. And by the way, in the end, is it even gonna matter? Because you'll be shocked to find out that Jair Bolsonaro has rejected those $20 million. He doesn't want it, because he doesn't want to save the Amazon. He's going to pretend that it's a feud that he's having specifically with France. No, he doesn't care. He doesn't want any international attention or focus or resources on maintaining the Amazon, because every acre that burns down is an acre less that they have to bulldoze. It's actually pretty convenient for the economic interests exploiting the Amazon right now. One last thing, I know we're going over, but let me take a look at this video. And I'll tell you what you're seeing. You're gonna see a little GIF, it's gonna be looping. And that is a plume of carbon monoxide over a significant chunk of all of South America coming from that fire. Carbon monoxide turns out not good for humanity. And that's just the most, those are the fires that are on right now. There have been tens of thousands. Fires, by the way, going on now, you can sort of see over on the side. Fires going on in a couple portions of Africa too. This is a gigantic problem in almost every way that a problem can be a problem. And in terms of our health as well. This is a gigantic problem. And the fact that these countries think that a little bit of change, like nothing out of their budget, that will save the lungs of the planet. No, they don't actually think that. It's to get the heat off of them. This is why we need that climate debate. This is why we need everybody who thinks that they have a chance of becoming president needs to be on the record, not just about what they're gonna do about the climate crisis, but about how they're gonna prioritize dealing with it. Because it's become very clear from the supposedly most responsible, wealthiest countries across the world, they are not going to prioritize it. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Lots of guests are gonna be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Primarying any incumbent in Congress is a difficult task, but it is particularly bold when you target the most powerful incumbent in Congress, perhaps Nancy Pelosi. And the person that bold joins us now on the Damage Report, Agatha Bacelar. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, John. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And in a little bit, I do want to turn to Nancy Pelosi specifically. But first, I would like to get to know you a little bit better, have our audience get to know you a little bit better. And so you are one of a number of primary challengers entering electoral politics for the first time. Tell us about your background.
Sure. So I'm originally from Brazil and then moved to the United States, where I grew up with my mom and in the public school system. I got a scholarship to go to Stanford, where I studied design and engineering. For the last 5 years, I've been working on documentary filmmaking and political advocacy across a variety of social justice issues. And it's being on the ground with the people and in the places where justice is most urgently needed that I saw so much unnecessary suffering that I believe is preventable. And since then, I've also started a nonprofit called Democracy Earth that builds decentralized open source voting software.
Awesome, awesome. Well, you mentioned your background in engineering. Our producers were looking into what percentage of currently elected congressmen and women have backgrounds in science or tech, and it's like nothing. And sometimes it's pretty obvious that it's nothing. So back during, sometimes like a tech executive will come in and they'll ask questions, and it's almost like they're like asking like their niece how to like reboot their computer or something. So from your point of view, having a background in this, what do you think having more elected representatives with knowledge of science and technology, what could that bring?
Right. Yeah, I think it's only 3% of members of members of the House of Representatives have any sort of STEM background. And here in the district, a majority of us are millennial tech workers. So I feel like I bring an understanding of that demographic. And I feel like we've gotten to a point where technology has broken democracy. So we need representatives who do have that sophisticated understanding for how technology could actually improve democracy. Why is it that we mostly only show up for an election every few years and then have our representatives go off with a vote when we could be collecting the majority interest in real time using technology?
Exactly. Now, turning to the primary, you are going to be going against Nancy Pelosi. What issues would you cite as the biggest differentiating factors between you and Nancy Pelosi? What are the biggest substantive differences between you two on policy?
Mm-hmm. I'd say I represent more progressive values. I support the Green New Deal, dramatic climate action, and creating millions of great new jobs, Medicare for all. And fundamentally, I believe in getting big money out of politics. So that cuts across multiple issues as well.
And is that going to influence your own funding during the primary and possibly the general election? What's your philosophy on fundraising?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, this is a grassroots campaign, and so we're not accepting any corporate PAC money.
Okay, well, that's always good to hear. Now, we've noticed a pattern over the past few years that primary challengers are not well received necessarily by the DNC, the DCCC. I have to assume that Nancy Pelosi will be, in particular, protected by those organizations. Has there been any communication with the DNC or the DCCC just yet from your campaign?
Not direct communication, although when I filed for candidacy, I did get some calls from members of the Democratic Party asking me to run elsewhere. But the blacklist has certainly affected our campaign, both in positive and negative ways, where we were signed up with software providers, and then they would have to say, sorry, you're on the blacklist. We actually have to terminate your contract. But then other people have raised their hand and said, sign me up for that blacklist. I want to support young, more diverse voices like you.
Awesome. So I want to get an idea of basically how do you go about running a campaign against somebody as well known, obviously in the district, but also nationally as Nancy Pelosi? What are some of the themes that you expect will come up during this primary challenge?
Right. There is a strong, Nancy Pelosi has been our representative for longer than I've been alive. And so there is support for her. And I think in this race, you can acknowledge, you can say thank you for your service, but it's time for a new generation of leadership. But also realistically, the biggest demographic in San Francisco are millennials, are young people. And I think it's our time, and we see that there's not this understanding of our issues. We have become the emblem of income inequality. We already talked about technology. And so all of those issues are going to come to the fore in this election.
Well, it is certainly going to be an exciting election. We're going to be keeping an eye on it. Hopefully we can talk a little bit more as it proceeds. But Agatha Bassler, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thanks, John.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is going to be joining us to break down a protest she was covering yesterday outside of the VMAs after this. Right there, you have protesters marching outside of the VMAs in Newark about the ongoing water crisis there. And joining us now, reporter who was there filming that video actually and covering the protest, Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you here, especially on short notice. And so I actually had not been aware ahead of time, other than your communication about it, that protest was going to happen. What was the sort of the origin of it? How did that come about?
Yeah, so it was not very public information. I was more respecting the privacy of the activists who I'd been in communication with about this very topic. And when I spoke to them, they just kind of expressed that they wanted to show up from different sides and basically storm the outside of the Prudential Center. It was this very jarring juxtaposition of these people, these largely young, seemingly affluent people in line for the VMAs mm-hmm. and the water protesters screaming from the outside. And it was like this gentrified former warehouse that had become this mm-hmm. entertainment center where they were having this very swanky party. And there were politicians up there, one in particular that I'm sure we'll talk about, who were onlooking those protesters. So I've been in communication with them, but I think they wanted to kind of make it a surprise because there was already massive police presence.
And I'm assuming that the VMAs happening to be there in Newark, oddly, because generally they're not in Newark, that was an opportunity to get attention on the issue. I, as far as I know, they don't have a particular problem with MTV specifically on this issue.
No, not at all. But I think what they did have an issue with was the idea that the mayor was putting on this large spectacle and bringing in these very famous artists, Taylor Swift, Missy Elliott, who's from New Jersey, but all these people that were performing and not addressing yeah. the root issue and the big problem that's happening in Newark right now, which is a nearly Flint level crisis with water in Newark.
Yeah, and so supposedly they had these filters had been distributed that turned out to be incredibly faulty, and now there's this need, like trying to set up a bottled water distribution, and there's promises I've been reading about that a bunch of money is going to be raised, all the service lines are going to be replaced. The activists you talked to, how hopeful are they that these proposed solutions are actually going to come to pass, and if they do, that it'll be relatively soon?
They were very pessimistic, and rightly so. There has been a long history of corruption and negligence in Newark itself. And it stems back to even, you know, pre-Cory Booker. But when Cory Booker was mayor, there was a lot of malfeasance. There was an infamous corruption scandal involving the Watershed Corporation. Basically, this Booker ally headed the water efforts in Newark, and she had a gambling addiction and was skimming money off of the top. And basically, they were getting $10 million a year to handle people's water, and she was taking, and the officials there, many of them, were taking at least $2 million off of the top and giving out contracts to people who were not equipped to actually adequately handle people's water. So while there's been no direct connection between the watershed controversy and what's happening with the lead right now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to draw the comparison or link the two, that Newark's water has been neglected for a really long time. And then the first lead levels were showing up in 2017. There were multiple tests, until the federal government just recently had to get involved. So the city of Newark has a lot of culpability for not acting sooner, although the mayor is currently trying to blame it on Donald Trump.
Okay. Donald Trump obviously instrumental in installing those lines and protecting them up until now. So he certainly could have done something nationally about the problem. I don't think in particular with Newark, he's necessarily the biggest factor. So any other standout things happen at the protests as you were covering them?
Yeah, so the deputy mayor of employment was at that kind of party before the VMAs. I did not know who he was. I saw that there was a man taunting the protesters, basically. It seemed like he was live streaming it, filming them for at least 20 minutes. And then an activist told me that he was in the mayor's office. And I did some digging, and he is a deputy mayor. And he's one of the higher ranking officials in Newark. And he was laughing with other people about it, filming them. And then when he was confronted about it, he essentially denied it and said, oh, they went after me first. As if you are immune to any criticism as an elected official. Mm-hmm. But it was especially brazen. And obviously the protesters were really upset. They said, you know, now the $120 million is coming to Newark to fix those pipes, and that's great. But they said, how can we trust that these officials who are literally mocking us to our faces are going to do right by us with that money and not do what they did under the Booker administration, which is skim off the top and take money for themselves, literally?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a story we're familiar with, massive corruption and then a personal assurance that there will be no consequences for anything that you do. That's a story we've seen across the country, unfortunately. Emma Vigeland, thank you as always for joining us. If anybody watching this would like to see the full video, including interviews with people at the protest, more footage of what was happening, it's available at Rebel HQ. Emma, thanks again.
Thanks, John.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, another candidate's gonna be joining us on the other side. Joining us now is congressional candidate for Arizona's 6th District, Anita Malik. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, John.
Glad to have you back. Now, we had talked previously in the last cycle. You had a run for Congress and you're running again. Talk to me now about the process of running for a second time. What has changed? What have you learned? How is it going to inform your candidacy in the 6th District this time around?
You know, I think one of the most important things that we learned was that you can prove that the voter's voice is more important than the money, than the rhetoric coming out of D.C. So what we were able to do in this district was really something special. We created a movement with, you know, over 700 volunteers. We were the underdog in a primary, and we were able to pull that off and then close the gap 14 points against a five-term incumbent, now five terms. And so we didn't get there, but we were able to do something that I think was really brought hope to this district. Mm-hmm. And that was important to me. What's different this time is it's actually doable. You know, we did the work. We built the foundation. We learned a lot. We learned about, you know, what is important to take from that political norm to what can we bring from this out of the box thinking that we were bringing from the marketing, the digital world. And how to do this. And it's doable. There's a little bit more pressure because of that. But we're prepared to take out David Schweikert this time in 2020.
So you mentioned this, but I want to focus on it in that this is this is a pretty tough district. It's a Republican district. But as you said, you narrowed that gap pretty significantly, which nationally is what the Democrats say that they're trying to do. They're trying to win the districts they can and make more districts competitive. And so hypothetically, that should be appealing to them. But it turns out that the DCCC is actually getting involved, but not necessarily doubling down on your strategy, which appeared to have made quite a bit of success, right?
Right. So, you know, we were, as the nominee last cycle, it's a short general election in Arizona. We have a late primary, and there was a lot of talk about why the DCCC did not put us on red to blue, was not very participatory in our race. Everyone said, this is flippable, this is possible, David Schweikert's vulnerable. And so we had to go at it on our own, and things were moving quickly. This cycle, you know, it's been made clear to me that, you know, they're trying to stay neutral, but there's been some indication that they have a different candidate in mind. And so we have a primary this time, another three-way primary, and it's ruffled some feathers, to put it nicely.
So you sort of implied there, but are they formally getting involved in terms of supporting one of the three candidates, or is it more of a sort of background implicit support?
It appears to be a background implicit support that we have felt. It's not something that they are going to tell us outright, but we've had our conversations. We're speaking to the DCCC as well. I will say the state party is being really great, but you know, for them, this looks very much, I call it a wealth primary. It's the idea of we have our candidate that can raise a lot of money, that can get, and so we're going to funnel those endorsements and that money toward that candidate.
Yeah.
And you know, the average voter doesn't understand that side of this, and so we're going to run our campaign our way. And it's unfortunate. It's a very strange feeling to go through everything we went through, to now be in this situation again, even though we're the nominee. Exactly. I believe in primaries. I believe in democracy. This one's a little bit unique.
So as we've pointed out, this is a more right-leaning district. As you're out there campaigning, what are the issues that you're focusing on, and how are you finding that voters are receiving issues that aren't necessarily coming from a right-wing perspective?
Voters are really open-minded. You know, this district is it is lean conservative in terms of registration numbers. We're outnumbered, but there's also a very large percentage of independent other voters. And so we're talking about healthcare, number one. And I have my personal story, which we're discussing and talking about that, those intricacies of the healthcare system. Everyone's experience with insurance and what's happened is a little bit different. It's a little bit unique. And so I'm able to have that conversation, and people are very receptive and very concerned
Gun safety is another issue. And then campaign finance reform. People, whether or not they understand what's happening with truly the money in politics and all the rules, they understand that that's the problem. And so with what's happening in our primary and our general is that I'm saying, look, this is about being accountable. This is about being transparent. This is not about a race, a horse race of money, right? This is about who can reach voters and who can have the conversation. And I think we're proving that, and we're excited to prove that out into 2020.
And I'm also curious, you know, as Donald Trump's presidency has continued, issues at the national level have shifted. Sometimes we're more focused on gun safety, sometimes it's about the Green New Deal. In your district, have you noticed any shift at all between your current run and when you were beginning your first run in terms of the issues that are foremost on your potential voters' minds?
I think the issues I just spoke about seem to be the same as the ones we were talking about before. I will say the climate crisis has caught people's attention more. People are asking those questions more. They are more concerned, and that is great to see because we do need to act. That probably is the biggest shift. You know, last cycle, I did have somebody, I'll always remember this, ask me at a meet and greet, and you know, when can we get people to care about the environment? And I said, I think once we can make sure that everybody has this, we need to figure out income equality in this country, maybe we can get them to care about that because they're not seeing the connection. And what is so encouraging is that now we've drawn the connection on so many of our great legislators in Congress today with the Green New Deal have really drawn those lines for people, and they understand what's at stake and that the two can work together and it can be a great economic solution.
Okay. And this morning you actually released an ethics promise. Can you tell us what's in that promise and what led to you releasing it?
You know, a lot of things. So like I said, with this primary that we're in, we feel that we need to talk about, let's talk about accountability. Let's talk about accountability because David Schweiker, the incumbent that we're up against, is under investigation. This has been a long-going investigation. It's over a year now. It's crossed into this new term. It's a bipartisan ethics investigation. He claims it's not a big deal, but really also is pointing fingers that he doesn't know where the money's going. And I think we see this a lot in our representatives. So for me, it's important to say, look, not only are we going to hold town halls, something that he refuses to do, and I invite him to a town hall I'm having here soon, but we're also going to post our public office spending. This is public dollars of your congressional office. We've noted recently that he spent a lot of money on furniture, and even more than Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, all the new congresspeople who should be buying furniture and needing things. So He's under investigation, spending a lot of money on legal fees for his campaign. And there's just there's a lack of accountability, a lack of transparency. So I'm really keen on promoting a lot of things that Senator Warren is talking about, which is let's make sure that we have a ban on lobbying for all congressmen. Let's make sure that we see everybody's tax returns. And so my pledge and my promise really breaks down all of those things. And as a candidate, I'm also taking a quite unusual step, and I have decided this round that I'm going to be my own treasurer. And the reason for that is that I'm the one accountable to what we're doing with our campaign spending and following the rules of the FEC.
Okay, that's an admirable move.
Yeah.
Anita, thank you again for joining us today, and good luck with your candidacy.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take one last break here. When we come back, Donald Trump versus Bernie Sanders on the future of journalism in America after this. The big new thing in the mainstream media over the past month or two has been to compare, in my view unfairly, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. There's no comparison to be made there, but they've been doing it, implying that vague statements from the two imply the same sort of policy goals. Well, fine. If they're going to be comparing them, it's my job then to contrast them. And I've chosen today's issue, which is Bernie Sanders' new plan on the future of journalism. He's taken a look at how newspapers and cable shows are going. What is the state of American journalism? And he has some ideas for what he would do were he to become president. But we know Donald Trump, not necessarily all that interested in the future of American journalism. In general, when he talks about American journalists, it comes in the form of tweets like this. The fake and corrupt media is so bad for our country, the enemy of the people. because one shooting in a newsroom isn't enough. He wants to inspire more. But of course, it goes beyond that. In terms of White House press briefings, those are done. We haven't had one in months and months. He often will target particular news outlets, particular journalists, attacking them, which doesn't only raise the risk that one of his out of control followers will attack that outlet. It also theoretically implies some sort of government action against them. He's talked about changing the libel and slander laws. He's talked about banning individual journalists from press briefings if they were to ever come back. And so his stance is very, very aggressive. But it's also personal in an odd way. In an interview once, he said, "You know, some of the media is among the worst people I've ever met. I mean, a pretty good percentage is really a terrible group of people. They write lies, they write false stories, they know they're false." And here's the thing, that is not the problem with the media, that they're just all terrible people who knowingly lie. There are quite a few problems with the media, but sometimes misdiagnosing a problem can be as bad as ignoring it totally. You wanna hear some ideas why the media is bad? Gatekeeping, for instance, the sort of people that are brought onto CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. Who is allowed, who is not? From what sorts of organizations, from what sorts of walks of life? The lack of diversity of virtually every kind, from gender and racial and religious to also ideological lack of diversity on these networks. That's important. The implicit pro-establishment, pro-corporate bias. Just the idea that the way things have been going are the way that things should continue to go. And anyone coming in and shaking things up is inherently a risk to the system that has treated them pretty well to this point. We know that there's an almost entire focus on insular domestic concerns, the rest of the world be damned, we can't bother with that. Setting up false dichotomies, the idea that every issue has two sides, even if most issues don't have two valid sides, some issues have far more than two sides, they always bring on the two people. There's a lot of issues. I could go on, I could do a full show. And Donald Trump, his issue with them is that they're mean to him. And so his solutions protect him. They don't actually strengthen American journalism. And that's where we turn to Bernie Sanders, who understands that that approach is wrong. Bernie Sanders says Trump's authoritarian bullying of the media is totally unacceptable and must be denounced and rejected. But let us be clear, that alone will not solve the journalism crisis. And he specifically points out in an article available on CJR, he talks about the more than 1400 communities across the country that have lost newspapers. He's talked about the newsrooms losing 28,000 employees over the past just 11 years. 3,200 people in the media industry have been laid off in just the past year. So he identifies the real issues. And I'm gonna jump ahead to some of the ideas that he has put into his plan. And you can read all of this and more, but some of the ideas include requiring major media companies to disclose whether or not their corporate transactions and merger proposals will involve significant journalism layoffs. So if you have consolidation or a new company buying either, you know, a newsroom, a newspaper, anything like that, are they going to reformulate it in a fashion that lays off a lot of journalists? That needs to go into these merger proposals. We'll also require that before any future mergers can take place, employees must be given the opportunity to purchase media outlets through employee stock ownership plans. That might have saved a lot of those small community newspapers, if not the bigger ones. That could have been big for diversity of media in big parts of the country. He's also going to they're gonna prevent media-related merger and deregulation decisions at federal agencies that adversely affect people of color and women, protecting the little diversity that actually currently exists as a building block for future expansion. They're gonna reinstate and strengthen media ownership rules and limit the number of stations that large broadcasting corporations can own in each market and nationwide. We'll also direct federal agencies to study the impact of consolidation in print, television, and digital media to determine whether future antitrust action is necessary. I mean, we've seen so much movement in the opposite direction, where in a city now, the same major corporation or even an individual will own a TV station, a newspaper, radio stations, making sure that there's almost no diversity of opinion available. And often, when the same individual owns these outlets across the country and then uses it to spread the same message, you no longer have perspectives that differ across areas, perspectives that differ across ways of life. You have the consolidation of thought as well as media outlets. And finally, he has his workplace democracy plan, which will boost media workers' laudable efforts to form unions and collectively bargain with their employers. Now, that is not under this media plan. That is a separate plan with a lot of different components to it. But this is another area where it would benefit, giving more power to the workers in this area. We've seen some efforts, especially in digital media recently, to allow unionization, strong unions forming. He wants to double down on that. And so, as with so many areas, the difference between these two, the current administration, their approach to the media, the First Amendment, the free press, and Bernie Sanders and what he would do were he to be president, it almost could not be clearer. Now, the media could perhaps pay attention to that more a bit in the future. We had on MSNBC recently, someone said that they were not aware of any plans that Bernie had put out. That's a big problem with the media. It's all available. You could read the articles online. Okay, thank you everybody for watching. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.